Foreign policy and strategic affairs is ever so important in the context of how world events have been unfolding lately. There's always more than what meets the eye, since diplomatic maneuvers mostly happen behind the scenes and away from prying cameras. And it takes a sharp eye to unravel what's happening. And our guest today is very good at that. He's one of India's finest minds in global power politics and foreign affairs. I'm delighted to have one of India's top brains in foreign policy, Mr. C. Rajamohan, with me today in a conversation. There are two important points in your career. One was when you were the member of the India's National Security Advisory Board going back to 1998 to 2000, which is when the Pokhran implosion happened. And at that time, there were severe restrictions imposed on us, sanctions imposed on us by US, Japan, and other nations, etc. You saw that very closely. How did Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee deal with it? And how did we move away from that in due course?
Yeah, I think the 90s were really the beginning of India's economic reorientation. It was also, you know, where India moved from, you know, the old economic model to one of reform. And I think the nuclear tests were critical. So we took a position, you know, we won't give up our nuclear option, but we won't exercise it either. It's one of those, we put ourselves in a Trishanku kind of situation. And the rest of the world was either trying to roll it back through the 1990s, actually, from the beginning, the Clinton administration said, look, rolling back India's nuclear and missile program was the main objective, and Pakistan's as well. Preparations were already done under Mr. Narasimha Rao's time. The debate, I think, in the political class at the time was, look, what are the costs? Can we manage the costs? Mr. Vajpayee took the risk, and I think that risk paid off. I mean, I think what we saw was initially there were sanctions, but I think within 4 months, Americans, the Stroop-Talbot dialogue, they began to engage India. And once the Americans began to engage and began to say, okay, we're not going to roll back, but let's find a compromise. So in a way, it was completely counterintuitive by defying the international system, but signaling openness for flexible engagement. I think India finally, you know, the nuclear thing, we couldn't spit it or we couldn't swallow it. That problem, I think, was cut nicely. And after that, actually, interestingly, the space for engaging the US opened up, even more counterintuitive. The talks with Pakistan began, that actually both countries were now nuclear. You could engage with all the divisive issues in a different basis. And if you notice, you recall, the engagement with the US was continued under Manmohan Singh and continues today.
Okay, the other important event in your career which interests me is when you wrote Modi's World in 2015, and you argued that India was expanding its sphere of influence under Prime Minister Modi. Now, 10 years have passed since then. Now, if you look back over these 10 years, now with tariff wars, the Iran crisis, a turbulent neighborhood, etc., would you say that what you foresaw at that time has proved true? Or you think that there's a need to revise that vision that you had at that time?
In our debate, often there is an assumption. We decide what is, you know, we have a doctrine, we have a policy. And the rest of the world is static. The rest of the world is not static. That actually the world is changing meanwhile. Even as you change, the world is changing. So there is a need for this constant re-evaluation of the external environment. Say when the UPA government, I mean, you had globalization was at its peak. Second, India was also growing at 8 to 9%. The global system was fully in favor of globalization. But then Trump has come and changed it in the first term itself. China has weaponized globalization. So therefore, the assumption that trade we can keep exporting and the rest of the world will simply, accept it. So that has changed in a way. The trading rules have changed. So you have to adapt to that. For me, the important mark of the Modi government was this: was actually we moved from coalition governments to a single party government. So for the first time since Rajiv Gandhi, who had a full majority in the Lok Sabha, you had a new government that didn't have to constantly look over its shoulder. You had a situation where Mr. Manmohan Singh, as Prime Minister, wanted to go to Sri Lanka for the Commonwealth Summit.
Ah, gosh, I remember that.
So you were Foreign Minister, I think, if I recall right. I mean, you had actually the Tamil Nadu party unit of your...
That's right.
Said, no, you can't go. I mean, it was an international summit. And you say, look, Prime Minister is not going to go for electoral reasons. So I think the internal divisions created a set of constraints. While Mr. Modi has command over his party, command over the Lok Sabha, that I think changes the structural equation. The second aspect, I think, many of the gains of the previous 20 years of reform were now there for the new Prime Minister to build on. So each successive Prime Minister, depending on his domestic standing, his cards too. As Trump says, you have cards to play in the international system. I think those have improved. And I would say, barring one or two areas where we are facing serious difficulties, in general, I would say your capacity to deal with the world has improved because of your economic transformation and the strength of the government.
Let's just come to the neighborhood now with the Hormuz crisis, etc. And we don't know from day to day exactly what the extent of that crisis will be and for how long. We, India, supplied emergency fuel supplies to Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Nepal, etc. When we ourselves were under very great stress, does this have a message that the neighborhood, the presence of China remains significant, but at the critical times when they require something, some intervention, it's India who steps in and does that for them? Is there a message about this at all?
No, absolutely. I mean, I think what you say, look, India, in a sense, is there to, you know, at crisis moments, they all turn to India. But don't expect gratitude. Don't expect them to say, look, we love India. I think that's not going to happen. That we got to recognize that within the neighborhood, there is a complex relationship in any everywhere. So there is interdependence, which keeps expressing itself. But as neighbors, we also have problems which need to be constantly managed. So both are realities.
Sometimes people say that both in Nepal and in Bangladesh, that the establishment didn't quite read the mood of the younger generations, etc. And then we saw the outcomes that led to the situations that we saw. Would it be right to say that we was also unable to read, or that we just felt that it wasn't necessary for us to read about what was happening there?
No, I would say that one set of structural issues, one set of subjectively, how did we handle it? The structural issues, I think, with Pakistan and Bangladesh, the problems are unique. Given the history of partition and the lingering issues left over by partition, in the case of Pakistan, those disputes have accumulated to such a strong extent that managing it, actually the whole relationship is frozen. With Bangladesh, I think we saw significant transformation. Under the UPA government, when Hasina came back to power 2010, from 2010, what Mr. Modi later called the golden period, where issues began to be sorted out. We sorted out the problem of cross-border terrorism, on trade concessions by India, and the opening up of the border, which got closed in the 65 and 71 wars. So you had actually 10 years of significant transformation. Then I think the problem comes in the subjective side. Is the problem is this, that you take your other side, you assume they don't have domestic politics. So the strategy for us is over the longer term, strengthen the bonds of interdependence. If the interdependence is strong on the economic front, I think it will create conditions to stabilize the political turbulence and the political volatility, which is inevitable. In real life, things happen, particularly between neighbors. So the capacity to engage all sections of the our neighborhood. In some ways, I think, in the case of Bangladesh, I think we got too attached, I would say, to Sheikh Hasina because of the history of 71 and the special role that she and her father had in creating this country. So I think we got a bit carried away by that because the signs were there.
Right.
In the after the previous two elections, which are not seen as free and fair, people are, beginning to get restive. So probably we were not willing to take that into account in understanding how difficult position she was getting into. So when she got affected, we were seen as her patrons. We also got affected.
This will continue because she's in India. And how, I mean, is it just a symbolic protest that one hears from Bangladesh, or is this something that that's going to be continued for a while? How do you see it?
You know this, right? I mean, in politics, you have to say certain things. Like, you'll have the Bangladesh government will keep demanding that, look, return her, return her, return her. As far as I can see, we're not going to return her. But the question then is, can you limit her political activity? So operationally, it becomes a question, if she's staying here and every day making a statement,
then
you have a problem. But
a problem.
As long as she's here,
yeah,
waits a turn, whatever it is, stay quiet, then it's a different story. So I think my sense is the new government, things seem to be going in the right direction. And for us, I think there is a recognition in Delhi after the 2-year interval in which Mr. Yunus and what all the government tried to do, how important Bangladesh is for us. Our longest border is with Bangladesh, 4,060 kilometers. Now, we export more to Bangladesh than to the Russians. And the damage, if instability in Bangladesh can do to our Northeast, is so immense. And I think the new government seems to be opening an opportunity for us to engage Bangladesh this time on a more pragmatic basis, on the basis of self-interest, so that we create conditions for long-term partnership between Delhi and Dhaka.
You've argued, if I've understood it correct, that India has historically seen its neighborhood through a prism of security rather than economics. But the neighborhood first policy, look east policy, does that change this paradigm? Substantially remains the same.
Look, I think we inherited from the British, I mean, this idea that we are the dominant power of the region, which was true for the British Raj. In fact, the way the British constructed the subcontinent, Britain was the number one power in the international system. It expanded, it created conditions for its total primacy in the region. So partition was one element we discussed. The subcontinent broke up. India was not the same as the British Raj. Now, we assume this is the natural state of things. Mm. But your ability to sustain the British inherited primacy was not there, because one partition weakened you. Your energies went into internal management of your new boundaries, new territories. But things changed after 1991 as India's economy began to grow, your toolkit began to improve. So if you notice, I mean, every single prime minister from Narasimha Rao, then to, Gujral, or then you have Vajpayee, or then Mr. Manmohan Singh and Mr. Modi, everyone talked about neighborhood first. Each of them in different ways said, look, we need more trade with our neighbors. We need more connectivity with our neighbors. So those ideas actually began to gain ground. But I think part of the failure has been across the board, implementing some of those agreements.
But when you look at Nepal, for instance, we've had a long lasting relationship with the political parties at different points that different governments have dealt with them, etc. Now, suddenly, you have a scenario in Nepal where we don't seem to be connected with anybody at all, and that you really have to rediscover. And the indication right now has been that the present regime that's now been established is inclined to look towards China more than it's inclined to look towards India. Is that a correct impression?
No, I don't think we should prejudge. I mean, they're barely there for a few weeks. The geography still favors India. What we say in Nepal, I mean, there is actually a natural relationship on the southern slopes of the Himalayas. But I think what India needs to learn is, look, you can't think of it in hegemonic terms. You've got to be more generous to your smaller neighbors. You've got to be, operate on the basis of interests. I mean, I think there's an opportunity here with the new generation. Start from first principles. What is it that they want? What is it that we can give? How do we do that? And what are the red lines from our perspective? What are the security red lines we want them to respect? And the rest of it, can we give them better access? Can they participate in our growth story? Those, I think it's doable. My sense is I'm still hopeful things would improve.
But you think with this on our plate, that we now have to begin afresh, take the best possible step forward, reach out to a whole new generation of public figures in Nepal, in Bangladesh, and so on. Is there some need to rethink about how we are dealing with SAARC? Is there now a dire need to revive SAARC and get it moving again?
Here is the problem on SAARC. I mean, I think the Pakistan is not ready for any trade or economic relationship. I don't know if you recall 2014, the last SAARC summit. Yeah. Actually, the governments had negotiated, I mean, the negotiations had started under the UPA government on interconnectivity projects, on, you know, freer trade, railway connectivity, road connectivity. The official level, Pakistan had agreed. Then you had the ministerial level that agreed. But when the summit took place, the Pak army pulled the plug. Came so close to doing something significant. And I think the same, if you remember 2013-14,
yeah, right.
Manmohan Singh government was negotiating with Zardari. You know, they said, look, okay, we'll give India MFN. Let's move forward on trade. But in the last minute, again, that collapsed. Same thing happened with Imran Khan again. So the important thing I would say, instead of waiting for SAARC to come, we have borders with all our neighbors. We have big trade relationships. If India improves its own trade policies, it gives better access to the markets to our neighbors. It improves trade facilitation on the open borders with Bangladesh and Nepal. So there are things we can unilaterally do. And I think SAARC can't be a substitute for that.
So that economic incentive or the economic advantage that we can use with all our neighbors, but as you have in the past thought that that economic advantage could be used as an effective outreach to Pakistan, is that since Operation Sindoor over? I mean, that option is no longer a viable option.
It is not whether we can do economic relationship with them. Pakistan is not ready for it. They prefer to do things with China or whatever it is. But much of our goods anyway go to Pakistan. I mean, here is the reality.
That is the irony.
Yeah. So if you set up a trade office in Dubai and say, look, anyway, your trade is going to Pakistan through Dubai or UAE. So I think let that continue. With Pakistan, I think the relationship is completely frozen. For them, they have to make a choice at some point that, look, how do they deal with the two neighbors, India and Afghanistan? Its economy is not growing. Today, its per capita GDP is below Bangladesh's, below $2,000. Its economy is in a shambles. So you would expect, logically, they would need more trade and cooperation, but they're not ready, I think, to make those choices.
And then you come to the dragon in the room,
China,
now with that huge trade deficit and issues along the border and line of control. What would you suggest to the government of the day? What steps can they take to deal forward with China?
Chinese military modernization has proceeded to a level where they've transformed their military capabilities. China today is the biggest producer of defense equipment, biggest producer of naval equipment, integrating modern technologies into their warfare. So their defense budget overall is about 5 times bigger than ours. And then on the border, they've completed their modernization. So for India now, the choice of, look, how do we deal with that military gap that has emerged? That is one problem. Second, on the economic side, China today controls 35% of the world's manufacturing. Every country has massive trade deficits with China. They attempt to produce more goods in India. Now, it is, you know, we moved in some directions, but the overall dependence on China, the overall limitations of India's manufacturing sector have remained. In the short term, you want to do more alternative energy, everything is controlled by the Chinese. You want to produce more pharma goods in India, the intermediaries come from China. So in a way, that bind is going to be with us for a long time. So I think you have a really tricky situation.
Given that the recent visit of Russia's first deputy PM, Denis Manturov, came and met with the EAM here and co-chaired the Intergovernmental Commission on Trade and Cooperation. And now we expect President Putin to be here for the BRICS summit in September. Where do we find the equilibrium that Western countries, Europe, trying to isolate Russia, India trying to fortify our relationship, which had been a very useful relationship to us over the decades, etc. How will this pan out?
Look, I think on the military political side, I mean, the India-Russia relationship remains quite sound. But it's on the economic side, the Russia's weight in India's overall economic policy has declined. The oil and other natural resources, Russia is rich in natural resources. But then Russia's conflict with the West has constrained some of that. The only good news, I would say at this point, is Trump himself wants a good relationship with Putin. So while the Europeans are opposed to normalization because they're locked into this Ukraine war, Putin is saying, look, we need better relationship with Russia. In fact, he's talking about, should I invite President Putin for the G20 summit later this year? This year it's going to be hosted by the Russians. So I think the Russians too, I think.
But what does he want to do? He wants a direct link with China. He wants to improve relations with Russia. And he's doing nothing for India. I mean, frankly, he hasn't done a great deal for India in the recent weeks. So where does that leave us?
So I would say that, you know, if you look at last 70, 100, even 100 years, the relationship between Russia and America, between Russia and China, between America and China have continuously evolved. So I think for us, we have to keep managing that change that takes place. But I would say, I think our relative position has improved. But I think we need to do a lot more, keep the Russia relationship going to the extent that is possible within the sanctions. Ideally for us, a US-Russia normalization would make it easier for us to do a lot more things. But then we're not sure. But our relationship with Europe is also growing. Russia and China getting into closer ties. So I think it's a complicated dynamic at this externally. So the only choice we have is how do we improve our internal strength so that we navigate this structure of changing major power relationship in a reasonable manner.
We have no ambition to be able to be more active in trying to get Russia and the US together, or for us to be able to bring Russia to be a little more acceptable to Europe, etc. Even in Ukraine-Russia matter, could we not have played a greater role as friends of Russia, not necessarily as adversaries to Russia, etc.? Have we just abdicated that role? I mean, are we just too preoccupied with other things to be able to do something like
that? Yeah, I mean, I think I would say we've been a bit cautious. Hopefully, we can do more in terms of doing things to facilitate. But I don't think we have the power to structurally change the core arguments. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you can organize meetings, or you can organize prisoner exchanges. You can organize, you know, in the Black Sea, the grain trade, we did a little bit there. So I think we need to be more proactive. I fully agree with you, both on the Ukraine issue, as well as even on the issue of US-Russia relationship.
But on the Hormuz crisis, for instance, on the entire Iran-Israel episode, where that does leave us now? I mean, I know there have been remarks about what Pakistan's role has been, etc. I certainly think that Pakistan is not the most deserving party to play the role that it is trying to play, be that as it may. But do we have any role at all? I mean, did we have a role at all between Israel and the Gaza issue? Do we have a role now with Iran? Iran seems to have been responsive to whatever India has indicated. But are we holding ourselves back beyond just saying, allow our ships to pass?
My sense is whether we can do more in terms of facilitating the peace process, I would say it is still, I think, limited. I wouldn't overestimate our capacity to step in directly, because when the principals themselves are talking to each other. In fact, one of the strange things on the Pakistani role, look, Trump always says, look, we should have a direct talks. In fact, if they sit down with the Iranians directly, rather than this talking through them through Twitter or through X or whatever it is, or Truth Social, they would get better results. After all, Obama negotiated with them. We had the CIA director going, Bill Burns going there regularly. We've had even here Witkoff and Jared Kushner negotiated with them till February. So I think the issues are so deep between them. I think it's best they have a direct negotiation.
Now, I need to ask you one question about the United States. There are different signals that you get from the United States. And of course, a bottom line is always that we are good friends of India. And certainly President Trump saying that Mr. Modi is a very good friend of President Trump. Where does he then come up with ideas like a hellhole India as a hellhole, and then put us in a position where we just don't know what to say in response, or for him to say that I've caused a ceasefire between India and Pakistan, and we don't know what to say. I mean, we collaterally, we may go around saying that, look, this is not true, this is not correct. But we can't confront him at all and say, sorry, Mr. President, that's not right. You're a friend and you shouldn't be saying these things.
I think we're really at a strange moment in the United States. I mean, I think we've dealt with far more hostile U.S. governments. I mean, if you go back to 71, sure, the Nixon government, or in the Cold War. I mean, but what you have is really a president who is almost crude, a vulgar, if you will, way, the language he uses. Not forget India for a minute. How he treats Keir Starmer. The closest, if you say, look, Brits are the closest you can get to the
allies.
And the way he says the European Union was designed to screw the United States. I mean, they're your partners. And he says, now I'm going to threaten to remove some of them from NATO. So I think you have actually a crazy moment in the United States, and expressed in the form of one man. Maverick doesn't do justice to his situation. This man is the president of the United States. He's the secretary of state. He's a desk officer. He's the press officer. He's tweeting when your teams are negotiating. He's saying things which actually complicate the negotiation. So you have actually a crazy moment in the U.S. politics. So I think India's focus, I would say, in the last 1 year has been engage the system, like our trade delegation was in April. Stick to the system. The signals with the system are reasonably good. You renewed your defense cooperation agreement. You're negotiating on trade because they're your biggest trading partner, rather than dealing with this man, I mean, on a daily basis.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rajamohan. Thank you very much.
Such a pleasure to see you. Yeah.